drawing room over here.
You made it. Oh, come on through. Do you fancy drink? What's your tipple? Welcome to The Drawing Room, a space for intimate and surprising conversations. I'm Andy Park. In 2011, Jennifer Egan won the Pulitzer Prize for her book, A Visit from the Goon Squad, an inventive and thoroughly entertaining work that connected the lives of her characters through 13 stories, each one told from a different perspective. Her latest work, The Candy House, returns us to the journeys of those characters, shifting through the past, present, and future as technology changes their place in the world. This is a book that looks at the power of technology, but is at its heart about the power of stories. The stories we tell ourselves, the stories that are told about us, and the stories that Jennifer shares. Jennifer Egan, welcome to The Drawing Room. Come on in, take a seat.
Thank you so much.
The book starts with Bix, the hugely successful founder of a social media app, and the idea that a life, no matter how successful, can become constrained. And that limits the ability to dream and to create. Is that your experience? Have you retained your own ability to dream amongst your success?
I think I have. And if I weren't able to, that would be really a crisis, because I feel like what I do in writing fiction derives directly from the world of dreams. And in fact, one of my most productive periods, especially in the last few years, for some reason, it used to be the shower, but now it's become that period between being fully asleep and really being awake in the way of like ready to get up and out of bed, where I feel like my brain is sort of flowing and floating. And that's where I solve a lot of problems in that dream space. So it's really essential that I have that mental freedom. And if I didn't have it, I would have to make huge changes in my life in order to restore it.
People talk about that as the concept of flow. When you're not exactly focused, it's this sort of nebulous thinking, this cloud sort of lofty dreaming thinking that helps you to solve problems. I have a friend who's a pure mathematician. He wakes up with the answers to his problems. Is that your experience too?
That's so interesting. Sometimes I don't know if it's exactly that I wake up with them, but I will often think I'm going to work now. And in a way, sometimes it really is just a rationalization, because what I'm really about to do is go back to sleep. But sometimes I will actually start to solve problems. Sometimes they're very minor problems. Like I'll figure out where to put that shelf. It's almost like my mind doesn't distinguish between what's really important and what is just a small problem, but it goes to work on various problems. And it does seem like the solutions kind of float into place in a very effortless way sometimes in that interim period. And sometimes they really are big solutions. Like I will have a major idea about something that I need to do in my writing.
So how come I can't remember where my keys are? And I can't solve the big problems in my life, but all of a sudden I have this sort of flow experience, or I go for a run or do my best work in the shower like you, and suddenly the keys are on the bench, but my bigger problems remain unchallenged, unsolved.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think that, you know, sometimes I think if there's a simple answer, it feels to me like that's the kind of problem solving that can happen in that flow state. It's not going to, you know, we're not going to solve the problem of Vladimir Putin lying there. It's not in our control, first of all. And it's, there's so much complexity to the problems, but I feel like somehow if it's just a piece that needs to fall into place, which can be really intractable, like there are times when that actually, as you say, you can't find your keys. It's a big problem. Those are the kinds of things that I think can sometimes, they're manageable. And maybe what it really is that the information was sitting there. We just couldn't access it.
That's what I find interesting. It's almost like we are our own block. It's just that we have to forget that to sort of find a way through. But I digress about my keys. Let's talk more about the candy house. I mean, the title of the book refers to the idea of the candy house in a fairy tale, a dangerous thing that appears to be inviting. It's a reference to social media in this case, isn't it?
Yes, although it's used in another context too, which is the idea of creating a kind of an event, a musical event, with the hope of bringing in a new generation of listeners and bewitching them. So it has a more benign association in that context. But I think if you think about the book overall, yes, I think social media is a fair target for that for the Candy House.
When writing about the current time, one of your characters talks about the self-surveillance era. What does that self-surveillance do to us? And are you making a reference to cancel culture?
I'm not actually thinking of cancel culture per se. I mean, the character who has that revelation is, of course, a pretty idiosyncratic fellow unto himself and obsessed with authenticity or the lack thereof, which is, I think, a preoccupation in our mass media era, for sure.
So it's vanity, it's narcissism then.
I think more that. I mean, but you could also talk about self-surveillance without any value judgment at all. I mean, it is a factual description of what social media consists of in many cases. Like, I see my kids taking pictures of themselves in a very almost humdrum way as just part of their social media experience. They're supposed to be sort of cataloging where they are all the time, and they do that. So I think that it certainly overlaps with narcissism and encourages narcissism, but it almost doesn't even have to be narcissistic. It is actually, to some degree, a requirement in certain professions. I mean, for example, when I was publishing my new book, The Candy House, my publisher really strongly urged me to finally join Instagram. I'm not that photo oriented. You know, I mean, fiction is obviously not a visual medium for the most part. And so I resisted. And in fact, even when I first got on Instagram, I just couldn't get it through my head that I had to include an image in every post.
you should have protested and just uploaded photos of the pages of your book. I mean, they're photos, right? But it's text.
Exactly.
It is your specialization.
Exactly. But, you know, the bottom line is that it is helpful to have a social media presence for purely professional reasons. People who do that well, and I certainly am not among them, they have an advantage in our contemporary era. So whether you are narcissistic or not, an ability to entertainingly surveil and present your life is unquestionably an asset.
So that's interesting, because if we can agree that there is this culture of self-surveillance, as you say, there are people that are good at it and it looks effortless. But for the rest of us, and I think you and I are in the same camp here, it seems effortful. It seems vanity, or it seems awkward. So is it just us that is awkward, and the rest of the world, particularly this younger generation, that are so effortless at this self-surveillance era?
Well, one thing is, I mean, for sure, I think there is a generational component, but look, Margaret Atwood, who is my mother's age, and I'm a baby boomer, is very good on Twitter. She is good at social media. So I don't know if it's exactly, it's not purely along generational lines that comfort, falls. But I will say that I don't know that I will ever be all that comfortable with this. And my experiment was, so I decided to take trains all over America for my book tour to experiment with a smaller carbon footprint. Trains in America can be really unreliable. I wanted to sort of test some of these famous routes and see how it went. And so I started taking videos, little videos of what I saw out the window, which was really fun to do because the scenery was amazing and it felt really natural to do that. And then I thought, well, I'll start sharing these videos on Instagram because that's where you're supposed to put images and videos. So I started doing that. And I liked doing it because I wasn't taking pictures of myself, which felt absolutely impossible. I couldn't do that. And then I found that after a day or two, you know, people say, oh, that's really cool, I love your video. And then I started to think in terms of the necessity of producing some more videos every day. And it started to feel like kind of an obligation. And it entered my experience as another factor of it, the need to reproduce this trip as I was having it. I mean, the need to produce my life, my travel, as a kind of product. And it was just striking because I thought, okay, this is something I would not be thinking about if it weren't for the need to represent this trip for an audience, which I'm doing because I so much don't want to represent myself, but it felt like an obligation. So some people seem to enjoy that and fall into it with pleasure and take on even a sort of creative persona. More power to them. I don't seem to have it in me.
See, I think we can't talk about this level of authenticity enough. Your comments remind me of the van life tradition or fad, if you like, people living out of their vans, seeking an alternative lifestyle, life on the road. But then very quickly, this movement, which is largely mediated by social media, becomes a commercial product. And suddenly they're eating a certain brand of chips. And certainly they're using a certain brand of, I don't know, hot water shower to bathe against the hot springs of some beautiful location. So very quickly, this idea of authenticity becomes hijacked with commercialism. Is that unavoidable?
Well, it's interesting because the kinds of commercialism you're talking about, I mean, that involves a business transaction that someone decided to make. You know, I will represent your product. And that's kind of a big leap. But I'm not sure that we can totally avoid the problem of something that begins appearing very authentic, becoming curated and somewhat artificial. I mean, think about reality television. The whole idea of that was that this would be more real, I mean, the name says it all, than, say, you know, scripted television. But guess what? Reality TV is extremely artificial, let's say. And so this longing for authenticity is part and parcel of a mediated existence and experience. And this is not my discovery. I mean, this was kind of a revelatory equation that I stumbled on in a book called The Image by a guy named Daniel Boorstin, who wrote this book in 1961. So all he was talking about was television in the 50s. There was nothing, the Vietnam War had not been televised. Mass media as we think of it now didn't exist. But even then, he identified the heart of what we're saying, which is that mediated experience feels artificial because it is. And that artificiality creates a hunger for greater authenticity, which the media, in whatever form it may exist, tries to satisfy. And this explains so much of what we see, you know, even now. Like, for example, I was taking the subway with my son the other day, who's 19, and he suddenly took a picture of both of us. And I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "It's an app called Be Real," which at a certain designated time, and they don't tell you when, tells everyone in the app, you have to photograph where you are and who you're with right now. No curation, no putting on mascara, boom. And the whole idea is we're going to all just see each other in a totally raw and authentic way. So I was ecstatic because it fit exactly into this equation that I'm so fascinated by and that I write about pretty explicitly in The Candy House.
So authentic, maybe yes, with that app, but spontaneous, very much not if you're being told by, you know, Command Central to snap to attention and be real and take a photo of your mother on the subway. I do want to move on because I want to talk about the collective conscious, which is the latest, greatest technology of your book. What is the collective conscious?
Well, the product that gives rise to the collective consciousness is called Own Your Unconscious. And it's very simple. It's a cube, a beautiful glossy cube, onto which anyone can download their consciousness in its entirety, every memory they've had since the moment of birth, for their own perusal. It's a private item, and it gives you the advantage of being able to review your experience from a present day perspective and fill in all the memory blanks. And there are a lot of other potential advantages. You also have the option of sharing it in whole or in part to a collective as the price of gaining access to that collective yourself. In other words, being able to view the memories and consciousnesses of other people. And when the product is originally invented by a guy named Bix Boughton, he assumes that this collective will be kind of a sideline and not a big draw, but it becomes the focus of the entire thing. And, you know, millions and millions of people join it. And it has a lot of cultural repercussions, which I don't get into too seriously, but I do show a lot of people using this device in myriad ways over the course of the book to accomplish various different goals. Looking through the eyes of a parent, let's say, at a day in that parent's life many, many years earlier, or in another case, finding someone about whom the protagonist has so little identifying information that he can't even look him up on social media, but he's very curious about what has become of this person. So he uploads his memories of that person, which are very few and kind of brief. And through facial recognition, he's able to look through the eyes of other people over many years who have seen that same person, and he can piece together what has happened in that person's life.
Wow, how fascinating. Yeah, terrifying. But for loved ones, people that you know and you've never met, you know, fathers and mothers that we died before we became adults, I mean, that is a fascinating idea. On ABCRN, I'm Andy Park, and the writer Jennifer Egan is my guest in the drawing room tonight. I want to talk about America and the narrative power of redemption stories, as Miles puts it in your work. What is that power, if you like?
Well, so Miles begins by being very sort of disgusted by the power of redemption stories in America. He's irritated because his kleptomaniac cousin, Sasha, has now kind of straightened out. She's gotten control of her compulsion. She's returned all of these items to people that she stole them from, and she's getting a lot of sympathy from other family members, and Miles doesn't like that. But Miles himself has a secret, which is that he's become very dependent on prescription medication. He's a very high-achieving lawyer. And ultimately, this drug dependency absolutely blows up his life and he loses everything. And ultimately, he comes back from these losses through a sort of a crazy sequence of events, but it does happen. And so in the end, he benefits from exactly the same appetite for redemption stories that he was so frustrated by at an earlier point. I am not entirely sure why we love these so much in America, except that I think there are a few things about a redemption story that feel very American, whether they are or not. One is, you know, let's face it, we began as a country full of religious dissenters, and there is a kind of, the sense of a kind of happier afterlife, of earning a happier afterlife through good behavior, I think is something that a lot of Americans in a very deep way might recognize in some sense. But I also think that, and this may be the more important thing, the idea of self-invention and reinvention is a very American notion. And again, I think it goes right back to where we began, which is with a lot of people who weren't able to function happily where they started out, coming here and beginning anew. And I think we have a tolerance for that and an appetite for that, although right now we're busy trying to keep immigrants out, so that doesn't really add up. But I think on a sort of cultural level and even maybe a kind of cellular internal level, we really embrace those stories about people changing their lives and triumphing in their new form.
Surely that also has something to do with the tradition of, being born again in certain evangelical churches. No matter how bad the sin, that can be washed away with a little bit of help from the church and from God.
Yes. I mean, the idea that no matter what you've done, if you renounce it and you start fresh, you get a clean break and you get to start over. That feels very familiar to me. I mean, I was raised Catholic, and, you know, certainly the idea there is that we're all sinners, which I disagree with, like right from birth, but that confession results in absolution. And so, at least at one point, we're a very Christian country. We've certainly become more and more secular, and there are a lot of aspects of this kind of Christian leaning in American culture that I think are very problematic, but maybe one of the positives is a willingness to believe that change is really possible for a human being.
Jennifer, I said in the introduction that Candy House is about stories rather than technology. Is that the way you see it as well? I mean, you kind of could have one without the other, if you like, people's stories and not the technology. However, they're a vehicle, if you like, for them to go through change, to make decisions, to be the victims of their own circumstance even.
I think it's very much about the stories and not the technology. I mean, the technology, the invention came into focus in all of its with all of its bells and whistles actually very late in the process. And it was really through the telling of these stories that I realized what I wanted the machine to be able to do. And the reason I wanted it to be able to do those things was so that I could do them narratively. So for example, it was really fun to be able to look through the eyes of an adult woman as she looks through the eyes of her father many years earlier when she was only six, who goes on an adventure. He's a straight-laced California businessman then, goes on a kind of crazy adventure in 1965 and ends up on a marijuana farm in Eureka, California, which at first he's somewhat appalled by, but ultimately it has a transformational effect on him, which results in his returning home a somewhat changed person the next day. And it turns out ultimately divorcing his wife and causing a lot of pain for both of his children, including the woman who's later watching this memory. I mean, just to be able to do that narratively, to be in two points of view at once, to be able to experience every sensory experience that her father experienced, but with her watching, was just really fun. And I couldn't have done that without the machine.
And that device, the machine, is so successful, as you've rightly pointed out. But the Candy House has so many chapters in such different styles following different people. Did every experiment work, or are there, you know, chapters that were left out because it just didn't achieve what you'd hoped?
There is a very high failure ratio with books like this, and it was the same with A Visit from the Goon Squad, because there are so many things that really have to come together to make it work. You know, it's a very kaleidoscopic, these are kaleidoscopic books. They are ensemble books. So each chapter is from a different point of view. Each chapter stands completely on its own. And each chapter hopefully has a different mood and tone and vibe to it. If I can't do all of those things and really make it live and hold its own amidst all of the others, I can't use it. And I would say it, for the Candy House, there was probably 50% of the first draft material that I began with that I couldn't use. Some of it I kept kind of pounding away until I was able to come up with something, but via such a circuitous route that it's really almost arguable that it really is the same piece that I began writing, but there are a lot of things that have to go right to be able to make one of these chapters work, more so than with a more conventionally written book where I have a sense of where I'm going. I mean, I have a high ratio of material that's not usable because I write in such an improvisational way in my first drafts. So that's always the case for me. But in a book like this, it can be kind of a heartbreak, because if I can't make a chapter work, that will often mean I actually can't write about that character in this book. I end up having to say goodbye to certain material that I was really interested in exploring. It's just not good enough.
Oh, wow. So you have to be that brutal with yourself, even though there are some strands to the story or character that could be productive, if you like, later on.
Yes. And even though there might be a part of something that feels promising, if I can't make a piece that is really strong and stands on its own legs, independent of all the rest, and has what feels like a fresh and you know, alive narrative approach, I cannot use it. And hard as it is to give some of that stuff up, what I know is that it will drag the whole thing down if I start pushing in material that's just not quite up to it. I mean, even as it is, some people find this book too confusing. This was the case with Goon Squad as well. You know, find these ensemble stories too hard to follow. And I think the big problem there is that they feel a necessity of following every connection, which no one should feel, and there should never be homework. But if I don't hew to the highest standard chapter by chapter, the whole thing starts to fall apart.
Well, Jennifer, you set an incredibly high bar, and this work is fantastic. Congratulations on The Candy House, and thank you so much for being my guest tonight here in The Drawing Room.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Jennifer Egan has been my guest in The Drawing Room. Her latest book, The Candy House, of course, she'll be appearing at the Sydney Writers' Festival on the 19th of May. You've been listening to a podcast of The Drawing Room with me, Andy Park. For more great conversations, search for The Drawing Room on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.